The title of the talk today is Walking Through Walls. And partly because some of this talk is to give some background on some of the guided meditations that we've been doing that are a bit new, at least to Open Dharma, I'd like to make sure that you know you can ask questions. When Gemma saw that my first subject in my talk was cement, she asked if I meant to talk about the porridge. She's not a big fan of the porridge. Anyway, it's not about the porridge here. But I was amused with myself to see how fond I have become of cement, how it brings a warm feeling to me now. Whereas my whole life until this year, it was something that I definitely liked to look down on. In the art building at my college, it was a building that was done by a famous architect, Le Corbusier. And it was a very cool design, and it had good indirect light, but it was made almost entirely of cement, and it also didn't have enough plugs to plug into. But the cement was the insult of all, the biggest insult of all. But since Gemma and I bought this place in Spain that we're slowly making into a kind of eco-hermitage, and we needed to redo some walls there, I was looking in some eco-building books, and I was surprised to find cement near the top of the list of one of the most ecological materials to use. I still wasn't convinced, but it did open my mind. I didn't know it was natural material also, by the way. I thought it was the perfect example of like human-made and not natural. It's something that has to be excavated from the earth and mixed with sand and water. And then it gets harder and harder and harder. Yeah. So it's not like there's enough cement to go on the way we're going forever. But there's also not enough wood, and there's not enough metal, and there's not enough water to keep going the way we're going. And then, as I started to be more and more convinced about cement, I started to notice other cement snobs who would come to Dharmaloka. So there was one good friend from Spain who came, and he wanted to help create a kind of stairway, walkway from one terrace down to the cottage that we're renovating. And since he was always questioning Gemma, why cement, we assumed he wouldn't want to use cement on his project. So we gave him nice rocks. And when he got to the top, he said, well, actually, to really make it strong, I need some cement. How much cement do you need? He used a few bags of cement on his stairway. So he still kept questioning Gemma, but he wanted cement for his own project. So as I was more and more involved in days of making cement, mixing it, getting the timing right, okay, now's the cement day, we're going to lay the floor, okay, everybody get ready. And being part of the process and kind of feeling my way into what Chögyam Trungpa calls the kind of, not the financial cost, but the kind of what shall we call it? It's kind of like a love cost, a love price. Like how much energy from the whole environment and the humans involved needs to go into a project, not just how much does it cost. What's beautiful about the way Trungpa talks about this, let's say, love cost, is that he says we've lost our willingness to pay the love cost. We don't take the trouble to make dinner for our friends. We go out to dinner. This is the way it goes in America anyway, United States. When I visit most of my family, what we often do is go out to dinner. And I can't wait to get to the other part of my family where our entertainment is to cook together. You would think after all these years in India that seven nights of restaurants would be the best thing, but it's really not. What I'm visiting for is to pay the love cost together. So Trungpa talked about festivals where people would donate tons of barley and yak butter and materials to have a festival that they could create together with the monks and the lay people. And knowing how that plant grew and was harvested and stored and brought on which animal cart, all of those investments of love, you could say, that went into something helps us feel the value of it and feel warmth to it, towards it, instead of just getting colder and colder and colder. So just to tell you about my love affair with cement is to kind of invite you to try to feel yourself and also other people, but especially yourself, in a different way that at first we might call objective, but it's not at all like trying to see yourself from outside. But really trying to feel what Ajay was maybe talking about the other day, about feeling the qualities rather than the personality of yourself. We hardly know what our personality is, how we present ourselves. We hardly can dare to see how we do that persona. When we see ourselves on camera or hear the recording or whatever, it seems, I never listen myself, but people report feeling embarrassed. So we hardly dare to see what is my personality, much less the qualities. But the qualities are much less fearsome, they're much less embarrassing. They're so easily lovable. And one of the ways to start to feel the qualities is through the kind of guided meditations that we've been doing some of the days, where we've been feeling, for example, the spleen. What is that? Maybe you never heard of it. Or we've been feeling the lungs or whatever. And I, in the same period of time that I start to have a warmth with cement, I start to have a kind of reverence for the forms that make up the body. Last summer, I read, speaking of getting to know someone that one doesn't like, or trying to feel the qualities of a personality that's not fitting, I was reading Ken Wilber last summer. And it wasn't as bad as I expected. It was easier than it had been 10 years before. And he was talking about human development as we're starting to move towards what would be called a mature ego, which we can then transcend. And as tiny babies, for example, what Ken Wilber is really pointing out in this book anyway, is in tiny babies, we could say, oh, the baby is in a state of union with the universe, with the mother, with everything. How wonderful. That's the lost paradise we're trying to get back to. And Wilber is saying, let's not call it a paradise because it's not the child's choice to be there. It is rather a kind of a hell, he puts it strongly, that we need to grow away from to come back to a more conscious union with everything on the other side of the ego. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So at some point in our slowly growing towards the ego, towards a firm sense of definition in the world, there's a mindset that we all go through, that we've all gone through, if we're lucky. Probably we couldn't have gotten here if we hadn't gone through it. We'd be in a hospital somewhere. That everything that we would see or relate with, this is a good example, would symbolize a body part. So something long and roly would be a penis and nothing else. And anything like this in the whole family of things in this shape, all penis. Okay. And then all the other shapes. So round breast, hollow vagina, etc. Well, it doesn't go beyond that. Those three very far, but anyway. it struck me that as we would kind of cross the place of mature ego, sense of definition, that we could come to a place, just as we have that reflection of the infantile unity, we have the mature flowering of experiencing non-duality once we've gotten through the ego stage. Once we've gotten through the ego stage, it seemed to me that the body parts, not just the sexual ones, may not just be symbols of something, but maybe actual doorways to different, a whole spectrum of spiritual qualities. They might be a way in that we could directly contact, because it's what we have. Without it, we couldn't do any of those steps of mature ego and then gradually coming back towards, or not back, according to Ken Wilber, come towards a true experience and ongoing experience of non-duality. And so it's interesting to see if we would just simply tune into different parts of the body and slowly get skillful at feeling the energy, or what some people call the mind of that organ or that body system, such as blood or lymph for the immunity. As we would become skillful in contacting that and entering that energy, we would be able to notice if we feel easy there, if we don't feel much there, if we feel like we've got to get out of here, and if it feels uncomfortable, is it uncomfortable, exciting, interesting, fascinating, cool, because it's like on our edge of what we're opening to? Or is it uncomfortable, I don't want to know about this, I've got to walk out of the room? It's so hard to know what we have to work with. What is a strength that's naturally there, a gift? What are our gifts? What are the places that, let's say, got stuck by not having the appropriate circumstances to flower? And if we turn to other people's opinions of us, then we'll get even more stuck. So one interesting thing about being in the role of sitting up and talking to people who are in silence is to have a really good lesson about how much people's opinions of someone else say about themselves. So I remember one woman on a retreat saying, "Do you realize how open and strong your first chakra is?" And then the next day, someone else, "Do you realize about your throat chakra, how amazing?" It was just like, I see your throat chakra is where you're interested in working. I see that your root chakra is what you're interested in. Or then there's the negative ones of not usually coming directly to my face, but feel free to come. I won't assume it's you. The control issues that Jaya has or whatever. And it's usually those people that especially are into that area that would see that in an authority figure, especially. So that's how we keep seeing each other. And so that would be one way in. What do I tend to criticize or also appreciate very highly in other people? That might give us a way to start to feel more clearly inside what's happening. What are the gifts and what are the places that got stuck, not through our own fault, but through the circumstances? There's a really great picture of someone, again, that I never would have imagined feeling warmth towards until now. But Mike Tyson, who you may or may not know, famous, infamous boxer. And there's a picture of him in my book that's talking a lot about these body systems and different organs and reflexes. So the reflexes that we have that are built in, that are available to us as human beings, also relate to different parts and aspects of the brain, different possibilities we have in our mind. And if some kind of conditions aren't just right when that reflex it would naturally be developed, then we get kind of stuck there. It's like as stuck as cement. So there's a picture of Mike Tyson in this, something like this. I don't know anything about boxing, obviously. But he's like this. And the caption apparently in the original newspaper or magazine or whatever was something like, as usual, Mike Tyson can't follow with the right. So he's stuck in this reflex that something like asymmetrical tonic neck reflex. He can't have the use of this arm because he has gotten stuck in the reflex that you turn here and the same side arm and leg extend and the other side arm and leg bend, which is part of crawling, is part of what we would use for creeping and crawling. And so this boxer made it into my current Bible. It's called Sensing, Feeling, and Action by Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen. Because she doesn't see Mike Tyson, what made it into the newspapers or whatever again and again. I actually was in India, so I only know like he's bad. That's all I really know. But Bonnie sees that, and she said, if only he could just release that asymmetric tonic neck reflex and get the symmetrical one happening, where you turn and you contract, and the other arm is free. All he would need to do is go into his eyes and better into his mouth, because the opposite, the underlying reflex, the underlying reflex is this one, which is about getting food to your mouth when you're just born. So maybe Mike Tyson wasn't allowed to do that. And so he got, this wasn't fully developed, and so then this gets stuck. So it's partly just examples of how we can love everyone. Somehow, from a distance, probably better in some cases. But also to talk about not only what these physical reflexes have in mind, like what they connect to in our minds, in our not only our thinking mind, but in our whole beings. But also to think about the possibilities of the other, like latent, the other potential natural, non-mental ways of moving that may be available to us if we would just have the right conditions for the right amount of time at the right time for that to just flower. So Chogyam Trungpa talks about the instinct for awake. So it's not that we're going to think our way and get clever enough to get through that kind of ego rainbow to the unity. But what if, just in the same way that all those physical reflexes are simply available waiting for the right conditions, and we can go back, we missed it then, we missed it when we were 6 months or 3 years old, we can do it now. We can go back, and we can even add our imagination and our love and our thinking to help that reflex flower, that physical reflex, that part of the mind and being that could then settle back and give a lot more space in the thinking mind and be free so that there's a much more range of response possible. There's a quotation from the mother of Auroville. Love opens all doors, pierces through all walls, crosses beyond all obstacles. And so when we talk about feeling different aspects of what we used to think of as purely physical experience, that we start to have an open mind that maybe it's not limited to that anymore. Maybe it was limited to that when we were 2 years old. That was a big enough challenge. But maybe it's a way into depth that can really help us bypass the thinking mind and also start to clear the creative mind from having to do so much of what could be simply reflexive, instinctual, non-thinking, being moved by life. Are there questions yet?
repeat the question?
The question was, could I repeat that last bit? Thank you. If I forget to repeat the question, keep asking. So the way that we're raised now, the mainstream culture on the planet, emphasizes using the so-called higher brain too soon to do things that it's not actually meant to do, that the rest of the brain, the, let's say the quiet brain or the non-thinking brain, is made to do. And so our creative space is taken up by trying, basically. Trying to sit up, trying to walk when it's not time. And so then there's a lot of trying happening in what could be our creative and so-called higher brain, and that we're not using the so-called lower or instinctive or reflexive, non-thinking parts of the brain that actually transfer information much more quickly. So they can handle a much bigger load without loading on us, that so-called lower brain. So I'm partly saying, like, it's partly just the fun of freeing up those very simple, basic body reflexes, just for fun. Why not be able to follow with the right if you're a boxer? And then the brain that comes with that, why not be able to feed? Why not be able to receive nourishment as well as reach out into the world? And then we apply that spiritually, nourishment and reaching out, going beyond what we already know, etc. We can let it filter all the way through the whole spectrum of experience. But also it's like changing also completely the mode from the trying and filling our headspace to kind of trusting that the potential is in us. And we may have the capacity, and we might also need help to find what are the conditions we need to have and for what period of time only to let those simple, let's say, instinct for awake, those different flavors of instinct for awake to flower as a very simple thing. So there's all the reflexes that we know of and how they could really help empower our spiritual path and growth. And there may be also ones that people haven't started talking about yet much. So for example, there's one place in the head. There's something called the mammillary body that this woman, Bonnie Bainbridge-Cohen, who's my current book guru, who loves Mike Tyson, despite himself. I lost my train. Where was it?
Place in the head.
Mammalia. Yeah, mammillary. Timelessness, that's my excuse. So she can go into that place and feel it, as can her students and her co-workers, co-teachers, whatever. And they can tell what it does. They can tell us about it. But when they look in books and they see the anatomical drawing of the brain, it's drawn in, mammillary body, with no description. And again, she keeps seeing drawings, very beautiful drawings, spiral with the center and so on. But there is not, so far, a scientific excuse for that to be in the middle of our head. So it's partly just to have in mind that there really are things even within our body that we can actually directly contact without knowing what it's about, and we can know what it's about. There might be more instincts for awake that we could really trust, and it's just about giving that care for that period of time for it to flower, and then it's integrated, and it comes with us. We don't have to think about whether I can use my right arm if I've done this. And it's partly just to see how collectively we discover truth. So I remember hearing about this planet, people aren't sure exactly if to call it a planet, called Chiron, It's small and weird, but it does seem to be a planet. And it was photographed in the 1800s, apparently. Late 1800s. But no one decided, oh, I'm going to name, this is my planet that I'm discovering, I'm going to name it. Or what is that? Nothing. It was just photographed, it was noticed, it was even mentioned, but no one said, wow, that's a planet in our solar system, until the 20th century. So it took many, many decades of knowing that it was there, a big object flying around the sun with us, before we could collectively say, that's a planet. Is that a planet? Is that a planet? A planetoid? An asteroid planet? What? And so the same with things not so far away, right inside our own realm of experience. If we could have that curiosity and the confidence to just go in the middle of our head and try to feel the mammillary body, for example. Or be willing to see in ourselves those stuck places, those things that when someone starts to bring that up, we go out of the room. So the blind spots where something got stuck. And also those uncomfortable places right on the edge of discovery that we feel very exposed, shaky, tentative, hard to contact the trust. So different people, each of us has more sensitivity towards different kinds of manifestations of energy. So some people are more sensitive to color, different colors and how that feels. Some people to sound, some people to even within sound, there's the notes, and then there's the what the consonant feels like, what the vowel feels like. Even the days of the week, some people could really tune into the energy of each day of the week. And then if we could use our strength, then we could feel the energy of that color or the energy of this day of the week, and then kind of let that be the wind in our sail or what we could have to help us today in our meditation. If today is about gathering in or contraction, instead of saying, I have to expand, it's all about expansion. We could find out what is it that is about, what do I want to contract? I want to contract my negativity, for example. So let's put the negativity in the contractor today. If it's about expansion, we're not going to try on purpose to expand our negativity. We're going to see if we can find the tiniest little bit of anything that we would like to expand and align that with the energy of the day. So that's one way that we can let our particular susceptibility or vulnerability to feeling the energies in our world. We can make it a little bit more conscious and then let it kind of give us a lift, a boost. So we have our strengths, we have our gifts, we have the blind spots. But also a big danger when we would start to notice something about ourselves and we would start to say, oh, I'm a color person, or I'm a day of the week person, or I'm a number person, or I'm a music person, or I'm a vowel person, or whatever. It so quickly becomes a box. So just a small example, I hope you can make the bridge to what I'm saying. In Jinshin Jutsu, we talk about the energies that we could also feel in our fingers. So if we hold the thumb, we could feel what's called in Jinshin first depth, which has to do with earth, and it has to do with thinking, and sometimes thinking too much or worrying, and also transcending the five senses. But if I would start to say, notice how often I'm holding my thumb, I might say, oh, I'm such a worrier. We'd go back to that reductive way of thinking, like, this is a penis, this is worry. Instead of remembering that there's also 12,000 things going on in here, according to Jinshin. According to other disciplines, maybe another 12,000. And so not to fall for that new creation of new walls that we would just squeeze ourselves into, that I'm special because I can feel the colors, or I can see the colors, and also I can only feel the colors, and I can only feel the colors in this circumstance with the specialness and the walls, feeling for the walls. in Jinshan, there's a beautiful image. I really love the image of geese flying. So they fly in their arrow shape. And they take turns leading. It's not just the one sort of alpha male or something that's always at the front. They take turns. They just, when they're tired, just peel off, and the next ones come to the front. And the image is about the kind of potential clear, clean, fresh cycling of the various energies that make us up, so that there's not always one leading. I'm not always a color person, or I'm not always doing this one reflex or whatever. But they have a friendly relationship. All these different energies have friendly relationship with each other. And they, when one is tired, naturally the next one is fresh and comes to the front. And so the possibility that we have of allowing that cooperation, trusting that that cooperation could be, that we don't need to always lean on our usual persona wall. We could have the courage to venture out of our snobbish likes and dislikes. We could love cement after hating it for 40 years. And we can leave room for this, such a beautiful discovering that keeps going on. So that also as I start to feel in myself, okay, that's the energy of the physical heart. I can recognize that in myself now after having gone there and felt what it feels like, what it needs, etc., as we've done with other organs here. And then we might start to recognize it in other people. And now this comes the other danger. Not only put ourselves in a box, but start quickly, happily forcing people into their boxes. Feeling the power of knowing that you're a heart person, whatever. So just a small example also to give you a sense of what kind of qualities the organs can have and how that can express itself in a human being. So there's something that in English is called a penetrating gaze. So when you feel like someone is really looking into you or through you or at you in an undeniable way. And according to Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, it could be that it's coming from the sexual organ energy. The physical sexual organs, their energy is penetrating and embracing, whether it's male or female body. Both penetrating and embracing. And that can come up through the eyes. It can also go down through the legs. And we can learn to see that and feel that in ourselves. But now we might start looking around for the penetrating looks. Or the embracing looks. It's interesting, I find that there are some penetrating gazes that are both penetrating and embracing. But there's also a penetrating gaze that can come from the spleen energy, which is about definition, clarity, like clearly defining, okay, you're going this way, I'm going this way, this is the border. It's about immunity, so it's like keeping out the germs or whatever. And this can also come up through the eyes as a penetrating gaze. But it has that energy of details and clarity and protection. So it's both penetrating but different. And then what if someone has both of those? What could it be like? So it's this a very delicate walking into feeling our specialty in ourselves. Feeling that sometimes we might be allowed to have a penetrating gaze, even if our training was, don't go there, don't do that, don't show that. That could sometimes be the goose at the front of the flock. But not to make it a new box that we or anyone else has to live inside of. So not that kind of love of cement. What Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen talks about as the thing that helps us reopen places that are stuck. She says, where we're stuck, there's a lack, the way she puts it is lack of cellular absorption. And then she explains herself by saying that what helps is love. So when we bring our look to a particular place in our body to see if we fall through into more subtle levels of our being through that doorway, through that seemingly solid thing, if we fall through into something more subtle, it's not that kind of penetrating, fixating kind of way of looking. It will have its just the right amount of penetration to get and to stay with and to see clearly, and not more than that, so that we could fall through to the subtle. And basically enough to make space for love to be present there. If we can imagine how fun that would be as spiritual practice, like having enough ability to direct, that we could direct love to the places that are stuck. And then that's all. Watch it flower by itself. And then let it be integrated, that it's not anymore my subject that I'm learning. It's now integrated. It comes to the front of the line when it's needed, and it goes back without any fight when it's tired. So as we kind of fall back behind the scenes, as we move through solidity into the fineness of our experience and allow things to be liberated, we will start to be able to see through walls that used to block our vision, and we will start to experience non-separation. And one of the myths that's important to dissolve about experience of non-separation, it's important to know that in experiencing actual non-separation, which is actually what is, when we start to release our places of stuckness, our walls that imagine separation, impose our images of separation onto vastness, there's still the joy of feeling all of the uniquenesses, all of the diversity, the spectrum of expression that keeps coming. So one important way of looking to add into our mix here, as I said, like if we try to see what are my qualities behind my personality, which I don't want to see, it's not going to be by as if I look up from outside at myself. But there's a way that if we really completely include ourselves in the picture, sometimes we'll try to have an experience of non-duality. Me trying to have an experience of non-duality. Me not having it, trying to have it. Me longing for it, and so on. And my other book guru these days, Matisse, Henri Matisse the painter, gives, I think, a very beautiful clue for our where we could place ourselves to be able to see clearly what this life is. His project that he came with, that he couldn't get away from, that sometimes he said was almost like a curse that kept him from his life as a natural man, because he couldn't stop painting. But his basic pull was to create a space of light by painting. So, and by the way, he's not just a color person, he also loved to play the violin. And he uses some musical metaphors or language sometimes to talk about what he's doing. He talks about the internal harmony of the color. So within the painting, not like referring to some idea of what color is, but within the painting, what his instinct says, okay, this red, that blue, and then what makes harmony with those things that the instinct called forth within this painting, within this subjective experience, not trying to be objective, And really keeping to a quite simple, like respecting the power of those simple colors, a simple palette. What brings forth a space of light? So this was a lot coming from his, we could say, instinct for space and light, instinct for awake, via painting. But then he talks about, sometimes he describes what he has done in his paintings. And one of the paintings, one of my favorite ones, his violin is in the picture and you can see out the window. He says, you see in this painting that the horizon, the window, and the room are not separated by the wall. So many people would look at that picture where it's a kind of a darkened room with a sunny day outside and just the window kind of partly open with the shutters and then bright light. And they could say, oh, he must have been in a dark phase where he could just barely see the light, and this kind of simplistic, reductive psychological interpretation. But if you look at what he says about the painting, it is at least as true as the other interpretation, where there's not a separation from horizon to here. And then another place he says, what I do is I include myself in the picture. But he doesn't mean like painting his body in. His perspective is included in what's on the canvas. And he says, sometimes I also include, I paint also the space behind me. So he's given up the old rules of perspective that would have blinded us to seeing in this way. And he puts himself in, he doesn't have to put himself literally in to put himself in. And he can even include what he can't see, what's behind him. The space behind him is included on the flat canvas. So if we have that kind of confidence to go beyond the rules of how we are supposed to see, and if we could let ourselves be in the picture without having to be in the picture, like without having to prove anything, without having to show anything, without having to be anyone. But our perspective is included, and even what I can't see, what I can't even talk about, I can't describe, put it in there. Let that be included in your view. So in a way, if I'm in the picture that I'm painting, and so is the space behind me that sees behind me, it's also not totally true when I said, okay, we don't try to be objective by looking from outside at ourselves. So we don't try to look at ourselves from outside in the way that we know, but as we start to let ourselves see that we are already included, there is a way that it is subjective and objective. So Matisse also said, like, it's completely subjective. It's my experience, my real experience. And once I come to the finished painting, this has become something real. This has become a true expression. So there's the terrifying vastness of non-separation. And there's the sometimes comfortable, sometimes cramped, various experiences of being inside our different walls. It's partly that kind of love of the cement. So if it's not like a hatred against the walls, but really seeing that it was from conditions that happened, that this wall went up, that this blind spot happened in my experience. And so also equally, I can see through it. I can learn to see through it. And then that gives rest to my creative mind. It gives more possibilities. As we keep opening our potentials and letting more and more of the spectrum of possibilities in us cooperate together without our say-so, without our giving the direction, of what's okay and what's not okay. As we trust in that vastness, that these potentials to live what we wish to live are actually with us, inescapably with us, just waiting for love to pop them. Love opens all doors, pierces through all walls, crosses beyond all obstacles. There are these, another famous set of paintings, the 10 ox herding pictures. You may or may not have heard of them. It's kind of a story of a meditator's path and befriending the oxen of the mind. But what's most interesting to me right now, so the person has gone through even an experience where it's just there's not a picture of an ox or a person trying to tame the ox or convince the ox or ride the ox or get trampled by the ox. It's just an empty painting. Even going through that, not even stopping, not letting that become a wall either, our idea of vastness, our idea of non-separation, as if that nothingness is it. Keep going, like keep letting, keep discovering, letting the instinct for awake move us, move you. The 10th picture is the person who's been interacting with the ox and the nothingness. It says under the picture, walking into the marketplace with empty hands, so leaving the mountains and the ashrams and the meditation centers and the caves, with empty hands, walking into the marketplace. Walking into the marketplace with empty hands, and everyone receives a gift. That's one of the translations. So I'd like to see if there's any questions. Benji?
Sometimes like it feels those natural places where there's, you know, certain qualities or areas where things appear more easily. I don't sometimes notice even when they appear, and it takes a kind of remembering to notice that that's not always how it is, or that's not obvious even to me. And in that same way, on the other side, there's a kind of dullness that I feel, especially with this going in the body stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that it's like that same sense of mystery as to why the mm-hmm. thing that I am naturally disposed to is natural,
yeah.
as the thing that I'm not is not.
Yeah.
And I don't know how either one came to be. And so, it's like it almost seems like, I mean, it's a wall, but I don't know, I haven't yet seen the concern, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to get in or mm. become aware or even, it's just a kind of dullness.
So that's something to start with.
Okay.
And also, especially that sense of mystery, that's partly what I meant about the love of cement, that it's, mm-hmm. It can be a beautiful thing that we have this wall, just as equally as we have this open view to the sea. And if that's all included in one, it's not a problem. It's a place to discover. And that's more exciting than depressing. And so then dullness is like, oh, I just have dullness. It's like, I have dullness to go on. I can tune into dullness, for example. And I do think that it's a lot to do with the confidence. Like once I let myself say, I have dullness to go with, so let me go with the dullness. If that's not depressing or insulting, and it's dullness,
mm-hmm.
it's cement. Okay, let's feel the cement. Getting more personally involved kind of thing, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Like letting there be warmth. I think it's mostly the confidence mm-hmm. to start. And then from there, it starts to unfold pretty maybe not as fast in 5 minutes as we would like, but maybe in 5 days, really pretty fast for like looking at however many years we've been alive, like a whole reflex is starting to get freed up and integrated, and it can also lead the flock sometimes. So many times it's just that moment of saying, oh, this is actually not a problem. This is what I get to do in this lifetime. Mm-hmm. One of the things. Cool. This is my, we don't want to make it too much of a work or whatever, but my workshop, my studio, my, my blank canvas. So it's blank. So what? What better place to start? So the confidence to stand in front of a blank canvas or a dullness or a wall. I think that we would often shy away from it because there might be pain involved in not in that having not been given a chance to develop. Mm-hmm. And because somehow it feels embarrassing that we're not perfect. Mm-hmm. And so if we can kind of walk through those walls of the possible pain, feeling somehow rejected or not quite okay, and any kind of embarrassment that I found something that is kind of not perfect in me, that's not fully developed already, that humility, then being with it is a more clear, direct. But it can also be that maybe it's, we'll find other ways that you could connect rather than trying to go through the body and, ooh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then maybe it becomes easier through the body someday, maybe not. Mm-hmm. It's not that we try to be all equally this much percentage of each energy, mm-hmm. all in the same order. Yeah. But not to give up too soon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I said I wanted to have an example of when you were saying to give more space and the right conditions for something.
Right. So, but also there's the example of Mike Tyson, where it's really helpful if someone, first of all, notices, which all the sports writers were noticing, he never follows through with the right when he's turned to the left. Okay, but then what? So even someone that famous or infamous or whatever, the trainer doesn't know that if he would just do some movement with his tongue inside his mouth, he'd probably be able to follow with his right. So in science, they talk about more of that, the connection of the eyes with this reflex and a certain muscle in the eye. But in Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen's way of looking at it, before, that what's important is also the reflex that's before that, that's the base of the foundation for the neck. So the basis for the next reflex. So go back to the previous reflex, nourishing yourself, hand-to-mouth reflex. Do something with your mouth, and probably it's going to just be able to flower. So reestablish the ground before, and then the next one may unfold by itself. That was her suggestion.
So you basically need to know quite a lot about how
well,
these things
work. You could know by this woman knows experientially more. So that means we could also develop that fineness. Or I feel like when I was speaking to Ben, it felt pretty clear that if I would just have confidence that, okay, I have dullness to go on. This is actually my project. In Jinten, they would call it project, not problem. That's the kind of play on words that they do. But then project could become also a problem. But this is fun. This is my discovery area. This is where I've got some walls to walk through. That's the fun thing. Okay. Then I just turn towards the dullness, and probably something happens, maybe not the tongue and the mouth, but something else, that I just start to, I don't know why, that's what I mean. I don't know why I'm doing that, but it's going to work if I keep following through. So it definitely can come, because we're included in the picture, something can just come. It's partly the trusting that all of that potential is there, all of it, the whole spectrum of potential is there. We don't have to be expert in everything, but we could have freedom of movement in more things. And it's not separate from us that we have to get the information here in order to release it. It's in us, so if we're trusting and open and the tongue, what? Okay, Lenny, I think you were next. Lenny G.
I'm seeing this on like two levels. On one, the purposeful looking and manipulation of this process, And then on another level, it seems like it's a very spontaneous thing that just happens. I mean, I'm sure you probably never thought in your life before, oh, maybe someday I'll switch that around and I'll like cement. You know,
yeah.
But it was just something that somehow in the mystery of the universe got changed, and then you were able to identify and see the processes and the all of those kinds of things. So I think what I'm trying to say is it can be, and perhaps is for many people, something that just naturally occurs, that don't know about Cohen's theory and how it goes, but just happens mysteriously, and all of a sudden this area is kind of flowering, and then other thoughts come, and, well, what about applying it to this, or what about that, and what, you know, all of that.
Yeah. So it's partly with the power of love. It has, so there was the example of the penetrating gaze, like to be able to see through a wall. We would think that what I've got to do is get my penetrating gaze going. Okay? But it needs to be just enough, like that wish to be opened by life, which includes the willingness to accept that where the walls happened to rise up in my life is not exactly so much people's fault, but this is what happens. It does so happen in everyone's life that there are places where there was not the perfect condition for everything to grow up, or for the walls to not have to grow up, for the walls not to come up.
So
it's partly the in love, that like being drawn towards what needs love, what needs the attention, what wants to be seen through, that much penetrating. So that wish in my life that why should I bother hating cement or Mike Tyson? Okay, so then there's like a calling towards opening beyond the walls. But then not that I would sit and look at the cement and try to love it. It so happened. It so happened in my life, the circumstances so happened that for fun, why not love cement? And so also in this work of Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, she just naturally sees, and then people wanted to learn it from her, and so then she starts making connections with actual human experience. So it's great that we say, yeah, there's mystery and there's spontaneity in love, and there's also in love precision and trusting our experience and letting that experience inform how we live and how we're moved. So without taking away the mystery, even from all of these bizarre reflexes that we have, that all of us have, that are moving our bodies through space the whole day. But it's mysterious, and we can also know it experientially without taking away the mystery, without taking away the chance to improvise, or the, in any way, rather it encourages improvisation, spontaneity, play, and wow, mystery.
And the key to it is the love.
Yeah, which is what she also says. In this one line, she talks about cellular absorption, but we can feel cellular absorption happens when there's love. And if I don't relate to the word love, what can I say when I feel like absorptive in my tissue? That's what people mean by love.
in the guided meditations, There's something for me tangible about the lungs, the heart. I can feel the function, so it's much easier to bring my attention to those organs. And other, you know, the stomach, it rumbles, it moves.
Yeah.
But the spleen, I just about know where it is, you know. It's like an organ that actually, you know, we can live without. actually. Right. It's not an essential organ. How I can just about use my imagination to mm-hmm. sort of place it somewhere in the body.
Right.
But bringing attention to it, to me, seems a complete impossibility, actually.
Right.
A bit like the kidneys, for example. It's like, you know, some organs we can feel the function, others they just, they may as well not be there.
Right.
Or perhaps.
Right. Okay. So, like I said with Ben, it might be that it's not, doesn't it need to be a technique that's worth spending time on for you.
Mm.
But it doesn't also mean that you just give up the first time. And it's also why I spent, like, what, 2 minutes on the spleen and starting with the lungs and then the blood, you know, like, starting with what's easier, yeah. But to call it an impossibility after 5 minutes of doing something very fine-tuned for the first time is that kind of, like, maybe worth attending to. Maybe it is possible. So what some people say is that the actual sensory feedback system is in place, and it's a matter of tuning into that in different areas. And the feedback is going to the brain from all of the organs. And of course, we're more aware of the ones that move and make noise. But the nerves are sending information to the brain from all of the organs.
Mm.
And so to call it impossible is such a strong statement that it calls my attention.
It seems impossible.
It seems an impossibility, yeah. But the very fact that it does, I agree, seem impossible, and yet the information is passing from the spleen to the brain and back. It's interesting that maybe it's not, maybe, okay, seeming impossibility, that could be like a call, like a challenge, like, okay, let's try again for 2 minutes. It's not going to kill me.
Do you think imagination is useful as a starting point?
Yeah. In some of the classes, they would give like a nice drawing of the anatomies or the kidneys on either side of the spine, at the base of the rib cage, in the back. Okay, you imagine that, you picture it, and then you start tuning into that place. And even if you don't know if it's kidney or muscle or skin that you're tuning into, but you're in the right area. And then what tends to happen, especially doing it in a group, is if I'm just in the right area, even if I'm not only in the kidney, I'm also in the muscle, the bone, the skin that's around. And maybe the adrenal glands are right there, so that maybe I'm including them too. But then in the room, something happens, and we're in kidney energy in the room. Mm. Kidney mind is awake. And then whether I in the room know that or not, it is affecting me. Maybe next year or the next year. Bonnie says it can be 1 or 2 years later that people come back and say, ah, kidneys, got it. So that's one of the reasons it's interesting to do in a group something like this. It's one way that we can experience the subtlety of the form, even though it seems like the form should be easier, but in the group sometimes the subtlety is more clear. Like with the spleen energy came into the room in that quick of a time. But I mean, did anyone feel their spleen?
Probably not.
Two. Does anyone know that they felt their spleen? So three of us? Maybe? Yeah. Yet in the room the spleen energy was awake, available, and we were all connected to that awakening. So maybe it affects our lives, maybe not, but probably for some people. Doesn't need to be for everyone. Was there another? Yes.
Did you say spleen energy was like boundaries or something?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, when you got to the spleen, I actually left, and memory came up of childhood. I took a break dancing class, and the room was really crowded, kind of like the meditation hall. And I ended up getting kicked a lot. And it was this really traumatic thing, and I actually left to go cry for a while, going through this memory. And it's so interesting. Boundaries, like, yeah. Just hearing that now, it's like that's what the whole thing was about, that got me, like, I gotta get out of here.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Thanks.
Interesting.
Yeah. I thought there was one other hand, but maybe I'm wrong. Okay. Okay, so let's have 5 minutes quiet time.